This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. We often look at antiques, vintage and old wares, artworks, etc., as things that are old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. It's easy to forget that each one has been made by someone, bought by someone, even commissioned by someone, used by someone, enjoyed by someone, or even impressed somebody. Always, of course, people as well, in plural. Today, we seek to include people in the way we look at things. We've added in the human ingredient to spice up a flute, a jester, a stuffed penguin, a trip to the Antarctic, some medals, and a stolen Van Gogh. We then look at some hugely creative, you might possibly say oddball, take your pick, approaches to art, and then a few things to bring us back more to solid territory. Please join me on this journey. And we start with man or woman as a creator and also as a user of these creations. Employment for one person becomes pleasure for another. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 8th of February. Feeling fluty? Popular in the first decades of the 19th century, the eight-key flute is something of a transitional instrument, retaining many of the characteristics of the earlier Baroque flute and the modern instrument. Among the best-known makers at the time was Ruddle and Rose, a partnership between the London flute player and instructor George Ruddle and Edinburgh wind instrument maker John Mitchell Rose that thrived from 1821 to 1850. Interest in the eight-key flute as an orchestral instrument waned in the Victorian period in favour of the modern flute, based on the designs of Theobald Boehm of Bavaria. However, the eight-key flute did remain popular with folk musicians. Since the revival of Irish music, in particular in the 1970s, they've been eagerly sought after. Only occasionally are Ruddle and Rose eight-key flutes seen at auction. This example here, in rosewood and white metal, with Ruddle and Rose patentees Boss to one end, was offered by Battle Auction House, Burstow and Hewitt, on January the 8th, with an estimate of £30 to £50. Plenty of bidding followed before it went to an internet bidder using the saleroom.com at £1,800. And all up, that's about $4,000. So, once a flute, always a flute? Does that story remind you of the French expression plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose? Which translates as, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Let's look at something that certainly does change with time. Let's stay with this theme of employment and pleasure, but in a very different light. And this is something that was probably okay in the 18th century, but probably way outside what is PC today. Is this sad? Is it about exploitation? Or just making the best of one's lot in life? And considering the alternatives at the time, was it all that bad? And this piece comes from the same Antique Trade Gazette of the 8th of February. And the title is Devotion is No Laughing Matter. This 18th century English provincial school full-length portrait depicts the jester, Black John. He was in the employ of the famously eccentric John Arscott, 1718 to 1788, of the Tetcott estate in Devon, said to be the last man in England to keep a professional jester. Black John, who had dwarfism and was under 4 feet high, was famous for his after-dinner tricks that included swallowing and retrieving several live mice tied to a string, and stripping a live sparrow of its feathers while his hands were tied behind his back. Black John was so attached to his master that after his death he built a shelter close to the church at Tetcott, where, with an old hound as his sole companion, he reputedly grieved away the remainder of his life. It was said he died of a broken heart. The 3 foot 5 inch by 2 foot 1 inch, that's 1.03 meters by 62 centimeters, oil on canvas that emerged for sale at Bairns in Exeter on January the 21st, with an estimate of £800 to £1,200, was seemingly a copy of John Northcott's, who lived 1746 to 1831, portrait of the same subject that is now in the Royal Cornwall Museum. Admired for both its folk art charm, unusual subject matter, and as a quirky piece of local history, it sold at £15,500 to a bidder using thesaleroom.com. Thank you, Roland R. Kell of the Antique Trade Gazette. Certainly not very many wealthy households employ dwarf jesters these days. I don't think it would be politically correct. And some of the antics described certainly wouldn't pass muster in this day and age. But moving along from live mice and sparrows, let's go to penguins. And this piece comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 21st of March and is entitled Buyer Picks Up a Penguin from Terra Nova. A taxidermy, a daily penguin collected by scientists during the Terra Nova Antarctic expedition from 1910 to 1913, drew strong interest at an auction in Essex last week. Offered at Saunders on March the 10th to the 11th, the 18.5-inch, 47 centimetre, high stuffed and mounted bird had been given to the vendor's family by the Terra Nova's doctor. Consigned with expectations of £2,000 to £3,000, it sold at £10,500. The buyer was Canterbury Museum in Christchurch, New Zealand, which will add the penguin to its diverse collection of Antarctic memorabilia and photographs. Bidding at the auction on the phone, it also secured a mixed lot of four watercolours and items of clothing belonging to Apsley George Bennett Cherry Garrard, 1886 to 1959, the youngest member of Captain Scott's Terra Nova expedition, at £1,600. The competition underlined the strength of demand for items connected with the heroic age of polar exploration. It followed the £9,000 bid for a penguin's egg from the expedition that was offered at Stroud Auction Rooms last year. Robert Falcon Scott's doomed expedition, which arrived in Antarctica on January 4, 1911, hoped to be the first to reach the South Pole, but it also had scientific objectives. The study of penguins, believed at the time to represent the evolutionary missing link between birds and reptiles, was a key part. The Adélie specimen, probably mounted by the London taxidermy firm Roland Ward, was given to the vendor's great-grandmother, Lady Porter, and her husband, Surgeon Vice Admiral Sir James Porter, 1851 to 1935, by the Terra Nova's doctor and parasitologist Edward Lester Atkinson, 1881 to 1928. In a letter dated December the 22nd, 1913, that formed part of the lot, Atkinson wrote, "Dear Lady Porter, I had hoped to have ready by Xmas an Adélie penguin as an Xmas present for Sir James and yourself. They have not taken so long over them at the stores that they will not be ready, but if you will accept it, I will send it as soon as I can." As the man in charge of base camp at Cape Evans, Atkinson has become a controversial figure in the Terra Nova story. He was criticised for the way supplies were organised along Scott's return route. It was Atkinson who led the search of the Great Ice Barrier, where on November 12, 1912, the bodies of Scott, Henry Birdie Bowers and Edward Wilson were found together with Scott's letter and diary, with its last entry dated March the 29th. And that was written by Alex Capon. Let's go back to Cherry Garrard, who was mentioned in the article, because he left a wonderful literary legacy, an account of the journey with Captain Scott, in his classic book, The Worst Journey in the World. And If we go to Wikipedia, it tells us that the worst journey in the world is a 1922 memoir by Apsley Cherry Garrard of Robert Falcon Scott's ill-fated Terra Nova expedition to the South Pole in 1910 to 1913. It has earned wide praise for its frank treatment of the difficulties of the expedition, the causes of its disastrous outcome, and the meaning of human suffering under extreme conditions. It's 600 pages long, quite a long read, but great fun. And it underlines that the expedition, Scott's expedition, was a scientific expedition. And as you know, Scott was pipped at the post by Norwegian Roald Amundsen in the race to get to the South Pole. But it's worth remembering that Amundsen was basically an adventurer and an explorer. He wasn't shackled by having a scientific venture, which Scott was. But you do wonder what would have happened if Scott had gone to the South Pole first before he'd carried out his study of the penguins afterwards. But let's move on to another story of human endeavour. A different stage, a different script, but only a few years later, and equally etched into a nation's history. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 21st of March. And the title is Naval Success Was Right on the Money. A First World War medal fashioned from a Mexican 8 reals coin was an unusual feature of a group sold at Burns, Hampton and Littlewood on February the 19th. The Belcham family group included this honour issued to commemorate the sinking of the SMS Emden by HMAS Sydney in 1914. The German cruiser had been hunting along Indian Ocean shipping routes but was surprised by HMAS Sydney when attacking the British radio station on the Cocos Islands. Badly damaged, the Emden was deliberately run aground. According to Museums Victoria, the medals issued incorporated a portion of the Mexican silver dollars recovered from the Emden. They were presented to the captain of the Sydney staff of the Cocos Islands, the Admiralty, the Australian War Memorial, and other approved Australian museums. The remainder was sold to the public as souvenirs, and money accrued above production costs were to go to the Royal Australian Navy Relief Fund. The Emden Medal was awarded to W.R. Belcham. The group as a whole sold to a UK commission bid for £2,700 against an estimate of £600 to £800. The lot was part of a large private collection that was started in the 1970s and had remained in that group ever since. The collection of 100 lots sold in Exeter for over £34,000. We've now had a look at people in a very positive light as creators, survivors, explorers, and displaying many different positive human qualities. Can the Antiques radio show produce you an example of opportunism, possibly tinged with selfishness and greed and other negative qualities, more often found in a Shakespeare tragedy? Well, let's try this story. And this comes from the Sydney Morning Herald, from the 1st of April, and it was actually sourced originally from Reuters. And the heading is The Netherlands, Van Gogh Vanishes. A painting by Vincent van Gogh has been stolen in a smash-and-grab raid on a museum that was closed to prevent the spread of coronavirus, police and the museum said. The Singer Laren Museum, east of Amsterdam, said that the Parsonage Garden at Nieuwenen in spring 1884 by the Dutch master was taken in the early hours of Monday local time. Museum General Ed Director Evert van Os said the institution that houses the collection of American couple William and Anna Singer is angry, shocked and sad at the theft of the painting. The value of the work on loan from the Groningen Museum in the North Dutch city of Groningen was not immediately known. I'm shocked and absolutely livid that this has happened, the museum director Jan Rudolf de Lorm said. This beautiful and moving painting by one of our greatest artists stolen, removed from the community, he added. It's very bad for the Groningen Museum, it's very bad for the singer, but it's terrible for us all, because art exists to be seen and shared by us, the community, to enjoy, to draw inspiration from, and to draw comfort from, especially in these difficult times. And the article continues with details of the police investigation. And it's sad that the picture has disappeared from public view and won't be available for everyone to see. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. And staying with our theme of people, this item comes from the art newspaper and was written by Gareth Harris and appeared on the 31st of March. And it describes a novel way to make a living in the art world and a new way for an artist to express his creativity. And the title is Tasmanian Museum Live Streams Human Canvas, whose artist-designed tattoos are worth €150,000. Tim Steiner, whose entire back is covered in an ink piece created by Wim Delvoye, will sit in the empty Mona Museum until the end of April. And the article reads, although it is currently closed due to the coronavirus COVID-19 outbreak, the Museum of Old and New Art, Mona, in Hobart, Tasmania, is live streaming a human work of art to laptops and mobiles worldwide. Throughout the coronavirus pandemic, Tim Steiner will sit on a plinth in the empty museum, displaying to online viewers his tattooed back between 10 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Australian time zone until April the 30th. In 2007, Steiner met the Belgian artist Wim Delvoye, who was looking for a human canvas on which he could ink tattoos. Delvoye covered Steiner's back with a tattoo of the Madonna, crowned in a halo, topped with a Mexican skull. The piece is entitled Tim, 2006 to 2008. In 2008, Steiner's body tattoo was sold to the German collector Rick Reinking for €150,000. According to the BBC, Steiner received a third of the sum. When Steiner dies, the skin on his back, daubed with the elaborate tattoo, will enter Reinking's collection. My skin belongs to Reinking, Steiner said. My back is the canvas. I am the temporary frame. As part of the deal with Reinking, Steiner must show the body tattoo in museums and galleries. Since 2009, he's exhibited his torso in eight venues, such as the Kunsthalle in Osnabrück, with previous stints at Mona in 2011 and 2016. Steiner says he has spent more than 3,500 hours on the plinth at the Tasmanian Museum, founded in 2011 by collector David Walsh. I'm not an artist. This is not performance art. I'm a regular dude from Zurich that sits on a box, he says in a film screened on Mona's website, which shows him exercising and meditating every day before the live stream. I'm the first person that is fully aware of how ridiculous this is. I'm an adult man that sits on a box for a living, and what I experience is something that nobody else in the world can share, he adds. Now, I wonder if that idea didn't come from Roald Dahl's 1952 short story called Skin. I won't ruin things by telling you the plot, but suffice it to say that an old man called Drioli, who has a tattoo on his back, which he shows to an art gallery owner, and, well, the story's written with Dahl's usual flair and brilliance, and I'll leave you to enjoy it. But let's move on to some more innovations in art, still remembering our theme of people. It helps if I can call to your mind or imagination, three paintings which you may well know. Firstly, Sandro Botticelli's Birth of Venus. Do you remember that beautifully naked Venus, obtaining some modesty from her long tresses, standing on a large shell in a watery backdrop? She's flanked by characters and some wooded scenery. Does it ring a bell? Well, if not, just try to imagine it. Secondly, The Last Supper, Leonardo's great mural of Jesus dining with the disciples, a long table with animated diners. And thirdly, there's Theodore Jericho's The Raft of Medusa, a crowded shipwreck raft with desperate individuals and a small mast with an inadequate sail and in a storm. I don't know if you know that painting, but can you imagine the desperation of the people on the raft? Well, that's our preparation for the article, which was written by Sarah Casconi and appeared on news.artnet.com and from the 25th of March. And it reads, Art World. The internet can't get enough of these images of masterpieces devoid of people. Most surprised by this development? The artist behind them, José Manuel Ballester, can take a crowded art historical masterpiece and reduce it to an empty room. What if art history's greatest masterpieces were, well, empty? In José Manuel Ballester's series Concealed Spaces, he's created replicas of some of the world's most famous artworks, exactly as you remember them, except all the people are gone. Today, many of the world's most famous gathering places are eerily empty as governments around the world ask their citizens to stay at home. Ballester's work seems tailor-made for the time. The artist, who began the series in 2006, uses Photoshop to seamlessly edit well-known masterpieces such as The Last Supper, 1498, by Leonardo da Vinci, The Raft of Medusa by Theodore Jericho, 1819, and The Birth of Venus, circa 1486, by Sandro Botticelli. And incidentally, the article does include some other images as well. In choosing which paintings to feature in the series, Ballester gravitated towards the most universal themes used throughout the history of art, war, religion, mythology, and death, he told Art News in an email. The resulting images, in which a sense of silence and stillness prevails, are both familiar and utterly unsettling, and there is something decidedly off in seeing recognisable paintings stripped of some of their most important elements. By making the compositions almost entirely bare, Ballester highlights the beauty of sometimes overlooked backdrops. But there's something undeniably sad about seeing Botticelli's scallop shell empty, with Venus nowhere to be found. That work in particular was an offshoot of one of Ballester's original compositions. I transferred the empty spaces that I portrayed in my urban landscapes to the world of classical painting, he said. Ballester, who isn't on social media, said he wasn't comfortable speaking about why the works went viral online, but he did admit he's been inundated with email requests to reproduce the artworks in recent days. In these circumstances, he said, it fits very well with the idea of staying at home. And the article conveniently juxtaposes the original paintings with Ballester's photoshopped versions. And if you don't know those paintings, just try to imagine a painting that you do know, stripped of people. How about a portrait with no one there? Let's move on to something less hypothetical and ethereal, something a little more tangible. What about the issue of the jewels and the jewel box? Isn't the box a very important adjunct to the jewel? Well, here's a piece from the art newspaper of March 2020, which casts some light on this question. And it's entitled Case History, The Objects That Protected Louis's Treasures. It comes from Madrid. When Louis, the Grand Dauphin of France, died in 1711, his magnificent cache of jewel-encrusted chalices, bowls, and centerpieces passed to his son, Philip V, the first Bourbon king of Spain. Executed in agate, diamonds, jade, silver and gold, the treasures of the Dauphin are certainly splendid, but a new exhibition at Madrid's Prado Museum will argue that the vessel's cases are works of art in their own right. Like their delicate, dazzling contents, the cases were created with great skill from the finest materials, carved wood, wool, silk, velvet, and Moroccan leather, stamped with golden motifs. Despite their grandeur, the cases have spent much of their lives in store. The 101 cases that will go on view have protected their precious cargo for hundreds of years, through conflicts such as the Spanish Civil War, when museums were bombed. A cornerstone at the Prado since 1839, this collection is one of the most complete of its kind. And that was written by Lauren Moyer Ford. So where does that leave us with museums? They're just giant jewel boxes. And isn't the fabric of the building as essential as the contents? Just think of the appropriateness of the building and its contents in the case of the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, or the Louvre in Paris, or even our own Powerhouse Museum in Sydney. And now, on a completely different tack, here's a story that appeared in the Antique Trade Gazette on the 25th of January. It really is quite extraordinary. 8 Victorian animal troughs stolen since September. And it's written by Laura Chesters. A total of 8 Victorian stone animal troughs have been stolen in recent months, with the latest 2 disappearing from Tunbridge Wells in Kent. Since September 2019, troughs have been reported taken from areas in South London and Kent, Penge, Bell Green, Downham, Chislehurst, Coombe Lane, Whittemore Green. According to Kent Police, the latest theft was an 8-foot by 2-foot, that's 2.4 metres by 61 centimetre, trough taken between 3 and 6 a.m. on January the 5th from the A26 London Road in Southborough near Tunbridge Wells. Like most municipal animal troughs, it's inscribed with the name of a donor, in this case the name of Sir David L. Salomons, with the date 1894. A second trough was reported stolen from Eridge Road in Tunbridge Wells, but Kent Police have not yet logged its disappearance. It's inscribed George and Annis Bills, - Australia, to one side, and to the other end, Metropolitan Drinking Fountain and Cattle Trough Association, MDFCTA. Historian Alan Underwood has catalogued and created a database of many of the MDFCTA community troughs and has been helping to collate information about these thefts. He said, "I first started researching MDFCTA's fountains and troughs about 15 years ago. I came across the remains of 5 that had been stolen in London over a period of about 5 years previously. To my best knowledge, in the intervening 15 years or so, before September 2019, only 1 further trough, in Woolwich, has disappeared. What has triggered the current spate of thefts? Anyone with information on any of the thefts should call the police on 101. And thank you very much, Laura Chesters, for that extraordinary story. You have to wonder who would steal a trough and why. They must be extraordinarily difficult to steal because they're so heavy, and they're immediately recognisable by their inscriptions. And it would be interesting to know who George and Annis Bills were from Australia and why they were sponsoring an animal trough in Tunbridge Wells in England. But that's people for you. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.